From WXXI News, I'm Michelle Faust, and this is Connections. Evan Dawson is out today. Today, our connection could be made every minute. A 2010 survey showed, on average, nationwide, 24 people per minute are victims of rape, physical violence, or stalking by an intimate partner. In 2012, Brockport College freshman Alexandra Kojit was beaten to death by her boyfriend, who was convicted and awaits sentencing on Tuesday. A more recent non-lethal incident brings up the question of public attitudes towards abuse. Last Thursday, the NFL announced Ravens running back Ray Rice was allegedly knocked out. He allegedly knocked out his wife, his now wife, unconscious at a casino in February. And he was suspended 2 games for that incident and given a $58,000 fine. Many accuse the league of leniency. Rice makes $7 million per year, and they call that a lighter punishment compared to a handful of other NFL players who have faced harsh consequences for nonviolent crimes. The incident and subsequent NFL and media reaction showed that not only is the intimate partner violence a problem, but public perceptions of that violence can also be problematic as well. On the program today, I'm joined in studio by Jamie Saunders, CEO of Alternatives for Battered Women, Jeff Peer, Director of Programs at ABW, and Patricia Huntington Siegel, Victim Services for RPD. Thank you all for joining me today.
Thanks for having us, Michelle.
Now, Jamie, I want to start with you. How common is dating and domestic violence in our community?
All too common. So I appreciate the opportunity to be here with you, Michelle, and really shine the light on what is often hidden in the shadows. The 24 people per minute across the country is profound. And right here at home, we know that there's over 6,200 cases that are reported each year. And those are just that are reported. By its very nature, people feel that they can't come forward. So we know the numbers are much, much higher than that. The greatest calls that come to 911, and our colleague at RPD could confirm this, over 30,000 calls a year come in this county alone around domestic disputes. So it's all around us. When we look at national statistics, it's 1 in 4 women, 1 in 7 men, because there are male victims as well. But by and large, this is around the people that we know. It's in everywhere from your school to your church to your workplace. It's all around us. So the answer is all too many.
So do we believe that the attitudes are lining up with the reality of the problem? What do you think, Pat?
I think we tend to minimize the problem. I think victims minimize the problem. Many victims think if they would just change something, the violence would go away. And it's not true. If somebody has an abusive personality, it's not just going to go away. It's going to go away to a new victim, perhaps. But many victims blame themselves, and many members of society blame victims, too. You know, if she did this, maybe he wouldn't do that.
When we talk about victim blaming, I think it's important to say when we look at the situation with Rice and when that came out last week, radio host Stephen A. Smith went on ESPN's show First Take. That was last Friday. He made a statement that suggested to some that women could actually be the provokers of domestic violence that happens to them.
We keep talking about the guys. We know you have no business putting your hands on a woman. I don't know how many times I got to reiterate that. But as a man who was raised by women, see, I know what I'm going to do if somebody touches a female member of my family. I know what I'm going to do. I know what my boys are going to do. I know what I'm going to have to remind myself that I work for the worldwide leader. I'm going to have to get law enforcement officials involved because of what I'm going to be tempted to do. But what I've tried to employ the female members of my family, some of whom you all met and talked to and what have you, is that, again, and this is what I've done this all my life, let's make sure we don't do anything to provoke wrong actions. Because if I come, or somebody else come, whether it's law enforcement officials, your brother, or the fellas that you know, if we come after somebody has put their hands on you, it doesn't negate the fact that they already put their hands on you. So let's try to make sure that we can do our our part in making sure that that doesn't happen. Now, you got some dudes that are just horrible, and they're going to do it anyway. And there's never an excuse to put your hands on a woman. But domestic violence or you know, with or whatever the case may be, with men putting their hands on women, is obviously a very real, real issue in our society. And I think that just talking about what guys shouldn't do, we got to also make sure that you can do your part to do whatever you can do to make to try to make sure it doesn't happen. We know they're wrong. We know they're criminal. We know they probably deserve to be in jail. In Ray Rice's case, he probably deserves more than the 2-game suspension, which we both acknowledged. But at the same time, we also have to make sure that we learn as much as we can about elements of provocation. Not that there's real provocation, but the elements of provocation, you got to make sure that you address it, because what we've got to do is do what we can to try to prevent the situation from happening in any way. And I don't think that's broached enough, is all I'm saying.
Now, Steve Smith has apologized since he made these comments. He called them poorly worded, and he says he knew better. But the original statement does beg the question to ask, you know, some people are wondering, can women ever logically do something that can result in them being hit by a man? Now, this victim blaming we just mentioned, Jeff Pierre, can you talk about, you know, how common is that? Is what, I mean, it seemed everyone in the room seemed very shocked by the comments of Steve Smith, but, you know, is it really all that shocking? Is it all that different than things that you hear all the time?
No, victim blaming is very common, and that's what inhibits a lot of people to want to come forward and tell their story. In reality, there's a lot of people that do believe what he just said, that things are provoked and that the cause of the violence is from the other person that the violence was based upon. The reality, though, is whether it's a woman hitting a man hitting a woman, it's still domestic violence. It's still violent. And if a man's the victim of domestic violence, then their job is not to retaliate with violence. Their job is to seek help, seek assistance, and have an opportunity to a more of a healthy relationship. So to say a woman provoked the violence against them, that is a normal common thread of knowledge that a lot of our victims go through each day that we're trying to get them to overcome, because the more we blame the victim, the less people are going to come forward to talk about it. The more we talk about it, the more people are going to know how to react when this violence occurs. So it is very common.
Now, Jeff Pierre, you've worked in the past with people in rape crisis situations.
Absolutely.
We recently, there was a lot of, it was on the front of the New York Times just a few weeks ago, a situation with a woman named Anna at Hobart and William Smith Colleges. And, you know, a lot of people say that she was blamed for her own alleged attack. And I wonder what your thoughts were on that.
In rape culture and rape cases, victim blame is very popular as well also. Again, it hinders them from wanting to come forward because they're very different situations. When people think about rape, a lot of people think of the stranger that rapes a person, when in many cases, over 84% of the cases, it's people that they know. So there's a lot of blame to when a victim tells their story about what happened. When the incidents occur on colleges, there's different justice systems, there's different methods of how they handle those type of cases. And I'm not here to say whether that's right or wrong, but it hinders someone's story from being told and probably the proper outcome to those stories.
Now, Jamie, you came in the room, seemed like you were pretty excited about some new legislation that's being proposed by U.S. Senator Kirsten Gillibrand and things to address this rape situation on campuses across the country.
Yeah, it's on the front page of the DNC today, and Senator Gillibrand has put forward a bipartisan bill, legislation, that is focused really on helping college campuses to report as well as to survey students. It's new legislation, so we're still getting our arms around it. The positive is anytime, frankly, we have a program like this, even making a positive out of the Ray Rice situation, is that people are talking about these issues, and we have to talk about them. So shining the light on it is already a win. The key parts in terms of looking at, you know, sexual assault on campus, it's to what Jeff just stated, we have to be ready and remove these barriers for victims to come forward. It's not about did she drink too much. It's not about what she was wearing. It's not about what he may or may not have asked to have happen, because, again, there are male victims that we have to be aware of. So it's to remove that, not so much focused on why did she do it, but why is he hitting? Why did he rape? rape? Why is there that entitlement? And when we listen to that piece, and it's hard to listen to some of the talking heads who are their job is to sensationalize this. And we want to most certainly acknowledge there are male victims. And despite our name Alternatives for Battered Women, men are welcomed, and we provide services for male victims. So we want to make sure that that's very clear. But women are 5 times more likely to be victimized. And that comes from a culture that, in our Western culture, that still has that difference. You know, I'm raising a young daughter, and I think of the same lessons that I was taught, the same lessons my mother and grandmother were taught. You do not walk alone. You don't go down the alley. Don't wear this outfit. Make sure you have your keys out. It's all of these defenses that we're taught as young girls, as young women. That's the way that we're raised. And watching these dialogues about, is it, you know, the men and the women, this is a human rights issue. It's about healthy relationships. It's about the that we all have the right to be safe and have a respectful partnership. And that's the focus.
Yeah, it comes. I want to go back to the idea of victim blaming, because I know many people who have been friends of someone who was in a domestic violence situation, or someone in their family, and they don't want to blame the victim, but they get so angry. Why don't you leave? I'm sure that at the police department, Pat, you've seen people who've come in over and over, or had calls over and over to the same
daily
family. Mm-hmm. I guess, first of all, how common is that of things happening over and over? And then I guess the question is, you know, what would you tell that family member that, you know,
what we do tell
why don't you leave?
Member. That is the biggest question for victims of domestic violence is, why doesn't she just leave? I mean, it's every day. The family members will ask that question. The victims will ask themselves that question. And there are many reasons why victims stay. But I have to tell you this, that when a victim does choose to leave is when she is most unsafe. That is when things start to escalate, because the batterer, the offender, thinks, if I can't have her, the offender loses all control at this point and feels that they're losing all control, because domestic violence is all about power and control. So when that victim chooses to leave, she is most at risk for being severely injured or killed. And that victim knows that. Inside, that victim really knows their own safety. And there, in addition to safety reasons, there's other reasons why victims stay. It's not just that simple to leave. If a victim has children with this person, very often they don't want to break up the family, or the offender throws this at them. I'm going to take the kids. Nobody's going to believe you. I make the money. I'm going to go to family court, and I'm going to get custody. So the offender uses the kids to make the victim stay. Financial. There's a whole, we could talk, honestly, we could talk a few hours why victims stay. There are many reasons why victims stay. Oftentimes now, it's safer.
Yeah, well, and what we're saying about victims staying and when they're leaving, that it's the most dangerous time. It's when they're most likely to be murdered by that assailant. You know, I wonder, Jamie, then you are helping these women. How do you advise them when they're trying to leave? Because there has to be a process that works or is slightly safer.
Well, the first part is that there is an expert in that story, and it's not us, right? It always is that particular victim or survivor who knows what they need and knows what's best for them. And as Pat just outlined, there's some very logical reasons why people stay. So ABW, we're here to provide any of those supports and services through our 24-hour crisis hotline. It's confidential, and that is 232-7353. So if there's callers out there who need assistance. But sometimes it's just to check in to figure out what you have and what you need on that journey. We work on safety planning, which are critical pieces to that. And I'm going to flip over to my colleague, Jeff Peer, who oversees this program for us in terms of our shelter. But we have a range of services. ABW is known most for our shelter program, but there are needs along the continuum. So the majority of people who receive services from ABW, it's at the Hall of Justice, as we have advocates there to help obtain a court order of protection, and that's our non-residential counseling. So if you are in a relationship and you don't know what to do about it, if you've just left one, or it's been 5, 10 years later, this is not a linear process. So it is an ongoing journey, and ABW is there for that part.
Now, Jeff, I do want you to follow up on that and talk about, what is that safety plan? What does that look like?
Yeah, absolutely. Safety planning is very important. And someone could just call the hotline, and we could go over that with them on the hotline as well, or as in person. But it's safety planning to just plan out the scenarios that possibly could happen. If you need to leave, what time is the best time to leave? Are your kids safe? Is there a place you could go? We do have a confidential emergency shelter ourselves. And it's just planning to make sure that they have the finances, a safety place to go, to make sure that, that they're just not running in circles right back into the abusive relationship. Planning is extremely important. And people might think planning is very easy and simple to do, but having a professional kind of helping you out with that plan to make sure there's systems in place in case something with the plan goes wrong, that that person will still end up safe. Police could get notified. So the plan is a journey. That's why they call it a plan. It's not simple. And it is actual action steps that need to be taken. That's why it's so difficult for, you know, our clients and people that are going through this to leave, because it is a big step.
For our listeners, if you have a comment or you'd like to ask a question to any of our guests, give us a call at 1-844-295-TALK, 1-844-295-8255. And I think it was really interesting something that you had said, Pat, about finances.
Mm-hmm.
Financial abuse is actually another type of abuse.
It is.
And people sometimes don't leave because they don't know where they're going to go. I recently did a story a couple months back of women who are homeless likely have experienced abuse in the past, and many of the times they become homeless because they have escaped abuse. So, I mean, it seems like there's a vicious cycle there. I wonder, you know, how do we address this?
There is. What we can help people do in that situation is try to help them get on public assistance. That's probably the biggest thing we can do if they're not working, or help them become financially independent. And that's where we partner with Alternatives for Battered Women, with their counselors that can help them with the long-term counseling to help them become more independent. But short-term, we want to make sure that person, instead of living on a street, is living in a shelter.
That said, I don't want to give the impression that domestic violence, intimate partner violence, is something that only happens to people who are in a low-income situation.
No.
I wonder what the stats are.
Yeah, so just under half of our clients at ABW are from the suburbs and the rural communities. So, we're most known for our shelter program, but we provide services for upwards of 20,000 people. So in terms of the contacts of the hotline, the shelter, counseling, court, it's all comprehensive. And when we think about the county and our population, it is in every single zip code. And we have a prevention educator who's out in the schools, all the districts, and it's teaching about healthy relationships, because we talk about this great legislation on campus, sexual assault, that is just out today, yet that's almost too late. It's so upstream. And we really have to be with our young people of what is a healthy relationship, what is acceptable, what is not acceptable of men and women, and when to recognize it's a dangerous one and what to do about it. And as a parent, I sit there, I struggle with this constantly. When do you share? How do you share? How do you model these behaviors? It's such a critical piece of our culture. When we talk about, you know, Ray Rice and the Ravens, you know, the part of that, again, is a positive, is now people are talking about it. The heartbreaking part of it is the two-game sanction, and I think it was actually $500,000, which may seem like 50, but it's $500,000 fine. And that in itself isn't the most upsetting piece. It's comparing it to the player who got suspended for a year because he smoked marijuana, the player who was suspended for a year for dog fighting. So the comparison, our culture is finding this acceptable, that violence against women and girls is not, if you look at this ranking, we have a problem. So we have to talk about that, and we have to, again, really focus on our cultural conversation of what it is, what it means, and how we can make a difference.
We'll continue that conversation about domestic violence and the cultural conversation. But right first, I'd like to, we have got a caller on the line. I don't know. We've got Lisa in the city, and she wants to speak. Hello, Lisa. You're on Connections.
Hi. Thanks for taking my call today. If you have a situation, for example, as an employer, where you know an employee is experiencing domestic violence, and it's escalated recently or something like that, is there something you should be doing as a general rule? And I'll take your answer off the air.
Thank you very much. Now, Jeff, I wonder if you have something that you'd like to chime in here. As far as we had spoken before on the phone about bystanders. What do you do if you know something is happening? Sometimes you can try to intervene, but sometimes that's not necessarily the best option. What would you say? Yeah.
Intervening could be scary for bystanders, definitely, because you might not understand the whole picture or how the person will react when you ask them or go to talk to them. My advice up front would be to go to that person and just make sure that they're okay. Ask them if they need any help or assistance. From an employee aspect, you could definitely offer EAP, some counseling, or even our confidential hotline that they could call. Sometimes people think that they're doing this alone, and just that little intervention from somebody in the work environment, family, a friend down the street, just intervening, just to say, is there anything I could do to help? I've noticed this. Just to give them an opportunity to talk about it. They might not know even what to say to you, but the best advice to give them is to let them know that they're not alone, that there are people that could help. And if you don't feel comfortable helping them, just give them the hotline number, because there are professionals in the field that could help.
And go ahead and give that number once more.
The hotline number, it's confidential. It's 232-7353.
Okay. And if you'd like to call and you've got any questions about being a bystander or anything else, 844-295-TALK. 844-295-8255. Now, Jamie, we spoke about, bystanders and people being afraid to come forward and do something. Is there any safety aspects that people who are bystanders should take into effect, and anything that they should really think about before they become speak up?
Well, I first want to commend Lisa for raising the question, both as a learning point and if she is an employer, that she has her antenna up and is paying attention. We started that it's 1 in 4 women and 1 in 7 men. So this is around us. I think about that when I'm at Wegmans or if I'm out on the sidewalk or looking out your window now if you're driving. Look at the people around you and just to be able to pay attention to the signs. And particularly we talk about dating violence. This is the same for domestic violence as well and older partners. Are they feeling more withdrawn? Are there bruises? Maybe. Those are some symbols of what can be of an abusive relationship. But there is emotional abuse, which can be as devastating, if not more, long-term, as science shows, in terms of post-traumatic stress and other impacts on the physical body. So the employers have a key role in this. And so that's a tremendous space to make sure that we are a safe place. In terms of bystanders, it's not only bystanders, it's what we say in the field as upstanders, which is making sure that we do not tolerate sexist behavior, even race and class come into this as well, that we stand up when things are not appropriate and when they're stated in inappropriate ways, and making sure we have a culture of acceptance and safety. When working with one individual and recognizing nothing is better than in a confidential moment to say, I've noticed some things, I'm concerned about you, I want you to know I'm a safe place. And not to do it with others around, but what if there's anything that I can do for you, what can I do now to help you feel safe? Just is that visibility. That person may not be ready to talk. They might not be ready to talk then. They might not be ready to talk weeks, months from now, or they may. But at least they know, as Jeff said, that they're heard, that they're visible, and that they're not alone. And so that's really the key message, is to be available, to be trusted, and to listen. The hardest part is to just to withhold judgment. We're such a fix-it culture. And I'm very much a fix-it person. I do it in my day job. I do it in my life. And you just want to fix what people are telling you. But that's not the role. This is about as close as you can get to your heart and soul of who people are. They're already very concerned and nervous about sharing and exposing themselves and what's happening. There can be shame. How did I end up in this relationship? We get that often, in that I am a smart, intelligent person. How can I have ended up in this relationship? They don't want to say. So if we, again, withhold judgment and just listen, and that can go a very long way.
And we're going to take a very quick break. We're talking about intimate partner violence right here on Connections. I'm Michelle Faust, in today for Evan Dawson. You're listening to member-supported public radio, AM 1370, FM 91.5, HD2 in Rochester, or FM 89.5 in the Finger Lakes. Thanks for listening.
Tune in to Connections for Arts Friday. We'll be talking to the co-owner of Ravine's Wine Cellars about their upcoming event in Geneva this Saturday night. The event, which pairs classical and jazz music with Ravine's wines, is designed to enhance your wine tasting experience through the sounds of local musicians. We'll have a sneak peek of the entertainment right here on Connections.
On the next Fresh Air, we talk with New York Times foreign correspondent Rukmini Kalamaki about her investigation into Al-Qaeda's lucrative business of kidnapping for ransom. And we'll talk about the trove of Al-Qaeda documents she discovered in North Mali, documents left behind by the jihadists when they fled, and what they reveal about Al-Qaeda's operations. Join us.
Tonight at 7 on your NPR news station.
And you're listening to Connections. If you'd like to join the conversation, we're talking about intimate violence, intimate partner violence. And the number is 844-295-TALK, 844-295-8255. My guests for this hour are Jamie Saunders from Alternatives for Battered Women and with Patricia Huntington Siegel. She's the Victim Services Representative for RPD, and Jeff Peer, who's also from Alternatives for Battered Women. I'd like you to really quickly, just so our listeners have the number, please give us the number for the hotline for people who have a concern about a family member or are experiencing domestic violence themselves.
Yeah, absolutely. Our hotline is free and confidential, and it's 232-7353.
Okay. I wanted to talk about a situation that happened just a few months ago. A male UC Santa Barbara student shot and killed seven women because he believed girls had always mistreated him. There was a lot of backlash about that. A lot, you know, it started some conversation about gun rights and violence and guns, but I don't really want to talk about that. What I want to talk about is actually Twitter. Hashtag on Twitter started called Not All Men, because many men were saying, you know what? We're not all like this. In response to that, a viral hashtag started called hashtag Yes All Women. And many women posted to that and talked about things that had happened to them, experiences of domestic violence, experiences of rape, just the feeling of what you had said, Jamie, telling your daughter to walk down the street with the keys in her hand. And the idea was, all women know that they have to do that. All women know that this is one of the things, it's just basic safety and life. And yeah, it's true that not all men are perpetrators, but yes, all women are concerned about that. And I wonder, Pat, is that something that you have an experience with?
Oh, yeah, absolutely, Michelle. I teach part-time at SUNY Brockport, and I do this exercise in class when we talk about sexual violence. I begin the class by asking the young men in the class, what did they do today to not be a victim of sexual assault or any kind of victim? And they sit there and they're really uncomfortable, they're struggling, they really can't say very much. Very little is talked about. And then I turn it over and I ask the young women in the class this very same question, and the dialogue goes on, and there's a list of things, and it's universal. Every woman in the class does things to protect themselves, from the keys to the dark to the friends. Some want to do background checks on people that they date, to all sorts of what they wear, who they talk with. And what's interesting is the men in the class never really taken a look at, wow, that's really what you all do here? And they're like, yeah, this is what we all do here.
Now, Jeff, as the one man in the room, I want to let you speak to this, because I worked with someone at a college that I used to work at, and she was in the violence prevention program, and she often would have people get very angry at her and think, oh, you're just trying to man bash. And I wonder, for someone as a man who works with victims, you know, where do you fall on this?
Well, definitely men could become victims themselves, but I would say, I would piggyback off what Pat said, is most men, when they're young, they're not getting told by their parents how to walk down the street with keys in their hand, to look over their shoulder. We're told, look both ways and be safe and come home. In most cases, young ladies are told, when you get there, make sure you call me, make sure you're with friends. So there is that cultural shift of men aren't aware as much of the violence that could occur, when I think women are more heightened to that than men are. To have those conversations, I think men will become more aware that women feel that way. With that said, it's not saying that all men are abusers, okay? But what it is saying is that women are more open to becoming abused than men are. If we look at the stats, and the 1 in 4 and 1 in 7. However, when you look at the stats across the board, it's 99% of them would be men abusing women. Okay, so if men stop abusing women and men become more aware and men become upstanders and supporters to women, then this violence could not only end, but we could really make a big dent in it. And so I think people in the world know that not all men are bad. And I would like for people to believe that, because there are men in this field, not just myself, that do this for a living every day, and that treat women with the utmost respect. But we also have to be aware that women do perceive their daily actions much differently than someone like myself. I don't mind parking in an empty garage. I don't mind walking up and down the street. I don't mind walking into a building full of people with worried about where I'm going to go, where I'm going to sit. Most women you ask, they pre-thought that out.
Yeah. I wonder, just kind of to go back to the situation of men who are victims of domestic violence or emotional abuse, I wonder, obviously we don't have the conversation enough even about women, but women know that they need to take precautions. But because we don't necessarily talk to our boys about it, does that put them more at risk of not knowing, you know, that some of the things that they're doing are abusive if it's not physical? And do we also put them at risk of not recognizing that they're being emotionally abused?
Absolutely. Education is important, and early onset education is important, not only from the family but within the schools. At a young age, young people need to be taught what a positive, healthy relationship not only is, but what it looks like. So they will see signs in themselves if they are acting abusive or if they've been abused. And I believe that does come from the family, as well as it takes a village to raise a child, so the people that they're surrounding with. So in the schools, programs like that we offer, the education programs throughout the community, the younger we could go, the young intervention, I think, makes a huge difference. Because when you talk to a lot of people that have been the abuser, in their mind what they did wasn't abusive, and not all abuse is physical. It's the financial abuse, it's the emotional abuse, it's just talking to someone and putting them down to the point where they don't feel like they have a say anymore or a personality anymore, and I'm going to control you. Some abusers think that that is normal, and that's okay, and it isn't.
Now, Jamie, you talked about education, and I wonder, you know, how does that education start, and how young should that start?
Well, I wanted to go back a little bit to just reiterate that we love men, right? So we date them, we marry them, we raise them, we work with them. So when we say not all men, absolutely, it's not all men. So we want to, obviously, we need men to be allies, not just for women, but also for men. Again, this is a human rights issue. It's a community health issue. So we want to make sure that we recognize that, and that men have a very specific role to play, as we talked about upstanders and bystanders and making sure that they're there. And that is how we change the cultural conversation, right? That's how, you know, the NFL is wearing pink for breast cancer, and I think that's fabulous. They're raising awareness about that. It impacts many people. Domestic violence is 3 times. So when will we see purple on NFL, right? When can we make this a conversation that is more acceptable and that we can make sure that all people are part of that conversation? Intergenerational violence, we talk about abusers. You know, when you look at it, most often they had abuse in their childhood. It's not always the case, but that most likely is an occurrence. I love that we have Jeff, who's this positive role model, and he's right there on our shelter floor. And you have these young children who are in shelter who see this excellent role model. And not only it's a male role model and it's a professional setting, but all of our staff to turn to mom and show her respect while she's in shelter. And that might be a first time that the child is seeing that. So modeling the behavior from birth on up is critical. And talking to our young people about healthy relationships. We're there at preschool, hands are not for hitting, how to be a healthy friend, and then truly by sixth grade, they're learning about STDs now in Monroe County in sixth grade. So we need to be talking about healthy relationships and what those look like. And what we often hear is by the time you're 9th, 10th, 11th grade, what they need is help on how to break up. So nobody talks about that. You know, we don't talk about how to balance your checkbook when you're in high school. We also should be teaching people how to have relationships and when that it's okay to actually end one and how to do it.
Now, Pat, I wanted to ask you, because we mentioned, we touched on this family legacy of abuse, and when you have people come into Rochester Police Department and they're calling, how often are their children involved?
If there's children, they're involved. So the children, many people think that if the kids are asleep, that they don't know anything about it, but that's not true. Kids always know. They're really in tune with what's going on in the house. So kids always know, and kids are always affected some way. They can be affected immediately by having some developmental delays come up. You know, maybe they're real little kids and they were potty training really well, and all of a sudden they're not. To their school relationships can suffer, their school performances can suffer. So kids always pay, now and later.
Jamie, is there a specific intervention for a child who maybe they've seen, I'll just say the mom, they've seen their father beat their mother? Mm-hmm. Is there a specific intervention, a specific training that's specific to them and their needs so that they don't become perpetrators or victims themselves when they grow up?
It's a great question. We don't actually cite a particular training tool, but what is not addressed is the children and what they're witnessing. And as Pat just stated, there are ramifications that go for generations. And so if we are going to disrupt the cycle of violence, we need to address the children's needs very differently than mom's needs. So at ABW, that's part of what we have, a separate children's program. And that is not only modeling good behavior, but working through play therapy and working through their own safety plan, because the child also needs their own safety plan. They're at school, they get off the bus, and their father, who's not supposed to be near them, what do they do? Or if mom there's an incident, should the child intervene? We don't advocate for the child to intervene. So what are the right spaces? It's heartbreaking. You know, when I first started at ABW and I'm walking the shelter floor and there was a teenage boy who was very withdrawn, his face was smashed in. It was smashed in by his father. So he was intervening for his mom. And here he is, and I look at this young man and the anger of him, and how can we as a community make sure that he feels supported, and what does his journey look like going from this point forward? So it's very specific interventions, yes, very different counseling and approaches to be for the children than it is for the parent, but it's all about family violence, and it's all about how we can, as a community, how we can, as providers, with our partners in law enforcement and the judicial system, make sure that we have the great supports in place when people do come forward.
Now, we're talking about children, but let's go a little bit older, to people who are teenagers, people who are just in college. My understanding is the majority of individuals who experience their first intimate partner violence situation, sexual violence, stalking, that happens by the age of 25. So most of these people are either in high school or in college. Jeff, what can we do about this?
Again, I think education and talking about it, and you know, and being on the college campuses and having programming, having people trained is very important. The freshmen that come in, to have them go through some classes, there's some education around, you know, what to look for. Because when people think about prevention education, they think about things like make sure you lock the door, make sure you walk with a friend, right? And the problem with some of those type of educations is if something still happens to you, then you're going to blame yourself because you forgot to lock the door or you forgot to walk with a friend. We really need prevention education and education as a whole to be more aware of what is safe, what isn't safe, what is a positive relationship, what's not a positive relationship, and also education around how to support and help the people around you and encourage bystander intervention. You know, we talk about all the time that stuff happens on college campuses. If you see someone drinking too much, or someone is maybe making a decision that could put them into a dangerous situation, or they're seeing a violent conflict between a man and a woman, or a man with a man, or a woman with a woman, that's still violent, we need to intervene. And we need to be the voice, because sometimes that's what they're looking for. They need someone to help out and someone to intervene at that moment. And a lot of times, college is where a lot of experimenting happens and things occur. And so you're going to see those stats rise up. It's the first time that young people are out of the house. They have the opportunity to make decisions on their own, which again leads to them blaming themselves for what happens. And we see it more too often that not only do they blame themselves, they don't feel worthy of getting any help and support because of their own guilt. And we need to break that barrier down.
Mm-hmm. We talked about that men can sometimes be victims, and so can women. But we really haven't touched on the fact that people in the LGBT community, mm-hmm. In same-sex relationships, sometimes this exists as well. Can you speak about that a little bit, Jamie?
Absolutely. And again, our name, Alternatives for Battered Women, doesn't provide the full spectrum of what we provide services for. So absolutely for men as well as LGBTQ. In New York State in 2008, they broadened the definition of domestic violence. So it was transformative because it's not just married couples, it's not just a child in common, but it's all forms of intimate partner. That we were providing those services before, but now it's much more comprehensive when you have that ability to do that. It's within relationships. So any type of intimate partner relationship can be viable or open to this type of abuse in the range. There are studies that show that it's higher rates in terms of same-sex partnerships. That's the same for other communities. The deaf community has higher rates as well. And it's these smaller communities and smaller close-knit communities where having an agency like ABW who's outside of that can provide some support and some services. I did want to also say in terms of college campuses and our young people, when you include stalking, so we didn't talk about stalking, which is also part of this dating violence. So we think, again, battered women, we think domestic violence, we think physical. We have broadened that through this discussion on emotional and financial and the emotional abuse. When you add stalking to that, it's 1 in 3, and that's the hot spot ages, of particularly between 18 to 25, where you see that those high levels of victimization. It's critical that we focus on that, and we also have to update our education, because in our prevention education, it doesn't necessarily include LGBTQ populations and what that means for our friends, as well as technology. So I learned this actually from RPD, and I don't know if this was Pat's story or Captain Strem, of the electronic leashing is the new mm-hmm. term. And maybe you could share about that, but the story where there was one of our suburbs that a teenager had to actually take her smartphone out and take a picture of who she was sitting next to in class and then send that to her boyfriend. And that was the way that, again, it's an electronic leashing, keeping control. Plus, we have on our smartphones GPS, you know where you're located. You can look at your emails, all of that. So these tools can also become weapons, and we have to make sure our antenna are up very high to be aware of those.
Now, Pat, I want you to talk about that, because this is something that I would imagine many of our listeners have never heard about. This is the first time I'm hearing of it.
Okay. Yeah, it's becoming more popular, because younger people are more, electronic savvy than we are, frankly. It's the only generation that was born into it. So there's ways for them to just keep on tabs, Instagram, of where their partners are, and start it in a loving way, like, oh, tell me where you're sitting. And then it gets into, tell me where you're sitting. I need to know where you are. And then GPS comes into play. And so dating violence is something that we really need to take seriously.
Also, Facebook, Instagram, all of those, we talk about the threat of outing. So you talk about our lesbian and gay, bisexual and trans folks, that's one of the threats is I'm going to tell your grandmother. I'm going to out you to your parents. I'm going to post this on Facebook. And that's another tool in the arsenal, if you will, of how to maintain power and control over another person. So, again, technology can be our friend, but it also has to be carefully monitored and that we have to be aware of it. We have a partnership with Verizon for Hope Lines, so when it may not make sense if you know that somebody's on your phone or you have your abusers following on your phone to turn it off right then, but we can provide you at ABW a safe alternative phone so that you can call us, you can have a direct line to 911, you can have a variety of ways while you work on your safety plan. So again, technology has to be part of the equation.
When I was working in Arizona, I heard a heartbreaking story about a family that they didn't really realize what was happening with their 16-year-old daughter who was being abused by her high school boyfriend who eventually murdered her. What lessons, what advice can we give to parents who are listening who really need to be paying attention to what's going on with their children?
We have to talk. This is not... It may seem like it's not dinner conversation, but it is. Mm-hmm. So we need to check in with our kids. We need to talk about it. We also need to make sure that we talk about the uncomfortable. And yes, you may have the eye roll, but they listen. You get the eye roll from your teenager, from your niece or your nephew, but at least it's out there and you planted a seed. So it's talking about it and saying, if this ever happens to you, I'm here. Or do any of your friends, have you ever seen, I mean, I started this conversation with my niece, you know, she's in high school. Do you see it locally? Do you see this? And, oh, yeah, this well-known of da-da-da-da-da-da-da, that they know it, but what to do about it. And to know they... Our kids may not come to their parent, to us as parents, but at least you can plant the seed and connect them to the resources where they can find help and to help each other. And that's the important part, but you have to talk about it.
Agreed. You have to talk about it. Either in dinner conversation, in a car, I find I'm a mother, too, of a 13-year-old boy, and I find some of our car conversations where he doesn't have to look at me face to face. He just spills just really informal and not even direct questions like, what's the best part of your day today? What's the worst part of your day? Just keeping the lines open that way.
Yeah. So we had talked about post-traumatic stress disorder. You had mentioned mm-hmm. that. And Jeff, I wonder, the thing that I would imagine causes the worst post-traumatic stress on this is that people, they're being hurt by the person that they love most mm-hmm. or that they trust most. What part does that play?
Well, post-traumatic stress disorder is definitely something we see a lot in the people we work with, and a lot of times the symptoms they're not even aware of themselves. So they're calling themselves, I feel crazy. I don't know why I'm so sad all the time. I'm depressed, or I get angry for no reason, or I've turned to drugs and alcohol to help me cope, or some sleeping meds to sleep at night. You know, the reality is they suffer trauma. And there's secondary trauma and there's primary trauma, and people in the family, people have to remember that the trauma comes from all different stressors. So, you know, what we try to do is to normalize their experiences and let them understand that what they're experiencing and their feelings are normal. So it's definitely the fact that they're intimate partner or someone that they trust is abusing them has caused that type of trauma to them or those feelings, but it's also the anxiety of when it's going to happen next. It's the feeling of why am I in this situation, and it's also the helpless feeling that weighs on them. And when you talk to many people that have been abused and been through these type of things, the one consistent is that they feel alone. And they feel empty, and they don't know why it's happening to them. So post-traumatic stress disorder, there's multiple articles, there's multiple books on the effects of that and what those look like. And I would tell people the first step to dealing with that is to talk to somebody. And then that doesn't necessarily have to be a therapist. It could be someone you trust that is safe. And then working with a professional to help you through that. But those feelings of post-traumatic stress disorder, the anxiety, depression, can't sleep at night, there's sleeping disorders, there's multiple things that occur when people are feeling that. And we need to be aware that what we're seeing is trauma, and what we're seeing is someone that is hurt, and we cannot judge their actions, because when people are hurt and they're suffering trauma and they're going through post-traumatic stress disorder, their decision making might not be the best at that time. So it's our job to help them out.
How do we encourage people to come forward? Because we had mentioned that, you know, a lot of people don't. It says most intimate, I from this study that I mentioned before, most intimate partner victimization are not reported to police. A fifth of all rapes are reported. A quarter of all physical assaults. Half of all stalking. These things are not reported to police, and even less among male victims. How can we get more people to come forward, Jamie?
Yeah, we say it's about 70% are unreported, at least in the dating domestic violence. But pick the number, it's too much. So it really goes back to the culture. These messages that we're talking about that we shared in popular culture and the media, that helps to silence. We need to rise up against that and say there are places where you are respected, there are places to go, there are tools, and a place, again, confidentially, as well as with the proper supports that you need without judgment. That's where ABW was born. You know, we were founded because this was unspoken in the 1970s. You didn't even use the term domestic violence. And a group of volunteers came together, staffed a hotline, and answered 200 calls in the first year. That's from volunteers. That's from people recognizing a need. And here we are celebrating our 35th anniversary. And we've grown because the need has grown, yes, to a degree, but the supports, we've become more educated about what we can do as a response. So I'm hopeful that these types of discussions, and I'm grateful for XXI and its role of keeping these conversations going, shining the light, is how we can, again, make a culture that's ready and doesn't judge and stops the victim blaming so that we're able to provide the proper supports.
Please give the number one more time.
Our hotline number at ABW is 232-7353, which I'm told spells self, but I haven't tried it.
Okay. We don't have very much time left, but Pat, I want you to say very briefly in about a paragraph, what will people get if they come to the police with their problem?
They'll get somebody, if they call the police, they should be getting a domestic incident report. It's a New York State standardized incident report that anybody that is a victim of domestic violence will have one filled out. Our unit gets copies of all those reports, and we follow up on the ones where it's a misdemeanor or violation, and we let them know about the support. And I would tell victims never to do it alone. Get an advocate. Get more than one advocate. We're here to help.
And you can call that number, 232-7353, and get help. I'd like to thank you very much, Jamie Saunders from Alternatives for Battered Women, Pat Huntington-Siegel from RPD, and Jeff Peer from also ABW. I appreciate you coming in today and talking about this, and I hope that if anyone out there is experiencing domestic violence, 232-7353 is the number to call. We've been speaking about intimate partner violence on Connections. I'm Michelle Faust, in today for Evan Dawson. Thank you for joining us. This is WXXI AM Rochester, WXXI FM HD2 Rochester, and WEOS FM Geneva.